What's going on, guys? Welcome to the show. Welcome. We are here to talk to you on this beautiful romantic Valentine's Day about our very romantic film, It's True Romance. You've been waiting for years for it. That's like what we say every single time now we do a new movie. You've been waiting for years for it because we've been doing the show for years. We're here to talk to you guys about True Romance. We'll see you in 1 second.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Action Movie Anatomy.
Boom! Yes! You're like vibing out and also doing your prep work at the same time.
Yeah. We are welcome. Hello, future Action Army.
Hello, Action Army. Happy Valentine's Day to you.
Happy Valentine's Day to you. I'm lonely and single. If there's anyone out there that wants to be my date,
Slide into his DMs.
Slide into my DMs on Instagram, Twitter. You can find me at Andrew Guy.
You can find me at Ben Bateman Media, Twitter and Instagram. We're here. We're talking True Romance. It's been a whirlwind a few weeks, and so
we're technically living in the past right now.
Scheduling got a little mixed up, and we had to figure out a way to tape some pre-tape episodes, which is never as fun for you guys because you don't get to be in the live chat. And there does. I mean, there is a live chat. We just don't get to interact in a live chat with you. That's the difference.
Yeah, I do miss that, and hopefully, if our schedules permit, I might be able to, I don't know if you will, I know you're going to be very, very busy over the next week, but maybe I'll be able to hop in the chat on Wednesday, tomorrow, and say hi to you guys, because this is a cool episode. This is a really cool episode
for
me.
It's a great movie.
This is a first time for me, and it's a big one.
Yeah, True Romance. People love this movie. It's like one of those, that's one of those movies that is a little bit representative of like another generation, which I think is really interesting and something that I want to talk about a little bit today. This sort of idea, like we're 29 years old, and so we have the movies we grew up with and what was really cool when we were growing up. And but like, if you're 45, this movie was cool when you were growing up.
Yeah.
So like when we, you know, this movie came out in 93. So like for us, the years that we really remember, like being teenagers into like high school and early college, where we like really loved movies and paid a lot of attention, you know, that was all happening in like 2006, 5, 4, 7. Mm-hmm. This movie's like a full 12 to 15 years before that.
Yeah, I'd say the movies that we ended up catching on the back end, or were on the back end of the 90s, the 98s, the 99s.
We were like little kids for that.
Yeah, but the big ones, like, you know, Gladiator coming out in 2000 was one of the ones that was like, oh, so that's like the beginning for me.
Yeah, we're 12 at that point, right.
Yeah, and Air Force One was 95, 98, 97.
Think, yeah.
Okay, yeah, so that was one of my, that was my first R-rated movie I watched with my mom.
But so I guess my point is, like, when I say the different generations of movies, I think it's not about necessarily the movies being good. It's about the whole idea of being cool. Like, this movie, when it came out, when Pulp Fiction came out, this era of movies, this was the coolest thing you could be doing.
Yeah.
There was nothing cooler than this.
And it embodies, you know, Hollywood in the, I guess, late 80s, early 90s, you know. It just feels very much like a time period. And it is cool. It still is cool.
Like, I guess like equivalent types of filmmakers and movies would have been like when the Royal Tenenbaums came out. That's like a good example of like the cool movie of when we were growing up, that all the kids our age were like, oh, that movie's so like smart and funny. And like, you know, it was like hipster. Like, if you were a hipster, you loved True Romance. If you were a hipster, you loved Wes Anderson. And you're like, that's the kind of movies people like.
Who is it now? Is it still Wes Anderson?
I mean, maybe it's like Denis Villeneuve or something, because he's making like Arrival and he's making Sicario. He's making movies that people think are really cool. I don't know. It's a different time. But that's one of the interesting things about this movie, is that it really does exist in sort of a moment in time. So we'll get all into that. This is Action Movie Anatomy, guys, on the Popcorn Talk Network. We talk action movies on this show here on the network that talks movies, pop culture, and doing it by the bucketful. The movies we talk about adhere to four basic rules. Number one, the hero always plays by their own rules.
I mean, Christian Slater just goes out and murders someone and then robs him and then runs. I mean, he pretty much plays by his
own
rules.
He does, man, and he, like, takes care of business. He's not really scared of anybody.
No, and Walken, rule number two is the hero and the villain are always the smartest people, villains, creatures, animals, things in the room. It's always tough in movies like this where you have someone that's kind of just led by an emotion.
Yeah,
like a passion.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't always mean they're the smartest. They kind of do dumb shit along the way.
Yeah, Slater does a lot of really dumb stuff. His decision in the first place was pretty dumb.
Like,
he's not... He's clever. He's clever. You know, he sets up this, when he gets on the phone with Lee Donowitz and he's having the whole conversation about wanting to open, what is he, the Great Ziegfeld?
No, it's...
Dublin, Dr. Zhivago.
Dr. Zhivago, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He wants to go open Dr. Zhivago and he's having, the, you know, that whole conversation. So he's pretty smart there, but, you know, he's definitely pretty dumb for...
Leaving his ID in the dead man's hand. Yeah. Walking the laugh, so...
Exactly.
Not the smartest guy.
Nope. Rule number three of the movie is driven by police, military, political, mercenary figure. He works at a comic book store.
Yeah, not at all.
No, not at all. And rule number four, the movie contains a minimum of one explosion. I don't think there's an explosion in this movie.
There's an explosion of cocaine.
A lot of cocaine.
There's an explosion of cocaine. I laughed out loud when he got pulled over and it blew up in his face. Like, that's an explosion for me. That was great.
That's a good moment.
It's a good moment.
So yeah, this movie naturally doesn't really hit a lot of the rules, but that we kind of knew that. And as we go with the show more and more, I think these rules do a little bit adhere to an older model, or a specific model, an older time.
Yeah,
when we were a little more specific with the movies we chose for the show because we covered a lot of those movies, and so now we wanted to be able to expand into other movies people love. So that's why we're covering this. So coming up today on the show, we're going to be doing all of your fun favorite games you guys love, like Fist Pump Moment, Favorite Line. We've also got top five Gary Oldman roles, Drexel.
Can't wait.
It's a hard one. And then we're also going to rank the cameos. This movie has such a crazy huge cast that we're going to be doing a ranking of who we think the best cameos are in the best order. But without further ado, I say we get into the trailer for this film before we watch the, or talk about the thesis statement. I'm all over the place today.
No, it doesn't matter. It's perfect. From the director, we don't have to deal with a live audience giving a shit. And Beverly Hills
Cop 2. Love you, Action Army. And Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Yeah, right. Clarence? I'm a married man,
buddy. A con man. I love the score for this movie.
Yeah, it's so fun. Doesn't Zimmer do some of it?
All of it.
He has all of it.
Yeah. It's an old throwback to a movie called Badlands from the early 70s.
Yeah. Same with the... narration,
yeah,
is a throwback to Sissy Spacek. What? She seems very nice. I can't remember. What are you doing in
L.A. anyway, huh? From Badlands.
Same one. Yeah. My name is Vincent Cocotti. Ooh. I work as counsel for Mr. Bruno Boyle, the man your son stole from. Now, all that stands between them and their wildest dreams. Find out who this wing and a prayer artist is and take him off at the neck. Are 60 cops.
40 agents. He's a wild man, this kid Clarence. I like him. 30 mobsters. I haven't killed anybody. 30 mobsters.
Since 1984.
And a few thousand bullets.
We're all gonna die here. These are cops!
The fact that Sizemore just kills him for throwing coffee on the guy is amazing. I definitely don't think they should have shown that all three parties meet in that hotel room in the trailer.
Hopper, yeah, definitely not. Val Kilmer, Gary Oldman, Brad Pitt, Christopher Walken.
Slow it down, man. In a Tony Scott film. I think what you did.
What a peculiar movie, man.
Yeah.
It's such a strange movie. Like, it...
Not since it's, and it, even the marketing, you can tell it's kind of
don't really know what to do.
Doesn't know which direction to go in. You don't really know what you're gonna get.
But it's also a true romance. It's a genre that didn't really exist yet. This became a genre for the next 10 years. So I think this is probably a good place to jump into thesis statement because I'll lead with mine. Mm-hmm. So thesis statement is your boldest, biggest thought. It's the thing about the movie that if the movie was to come up and you wanted to start a conversation with someone at a party, you'd really stand on your soapbox and talk about this one thing.
Yeah, if you only had 1 minute and 30 seconds to give your point, and you can only give one, this would be it.
The boldest, strongest statement you have about the film. And
I think both of ours are pretty damn bold.
Yeah, so I'm going to go ahead and say that... this is the most indicative film of Quentin Tarantino as a filmmaker ever made, which is funny because Quentin Tarantino didn't make the movie. He just sold the script.
Yeah. What's really interesting is when you first said that, I immediately countered with he didn't direct it and he didn't want to direct it. He lost interest for some reason, and that for me took away from it. But going and watching this for the first time last week, I did... realize when watching it, I was like, this is everything about this is so Tarantino. There's tension building, there's comedy, there's excessive use of the N-word, there is drugs, there's a shootout, there's all these things, there's these monologues, there's tension building scenes with two powerhouse actors.
Yeah.
And the more I thought about it, because I had the same thought until I realized he didn't direct it, I think I completely agree with you.
It's like, it's funny, the more you watch Tarantino's movies, the older he gets and the more movies he does, the more you sort of realize that the essence of Quentin Tarantino as a filmmaker, it all came from this genre. Because this is the first script he ever wrote, poured it over. He wrote a script called My Best Friend's Birthday, which was like in the late 80s, his first script he ever wrote. And that became the basis for most of this script. Now, this script was 500 pages, and half of it became Natural Born Killers, and half of it became this movie. But just like... The super like film enthusiast, comic book nerd main protagonist who kind of knows the most about movies, he knows everything, that's a very Tarantino trait. The fact that like it's everything about it is a little overly violent. There's so many characters. Every one of these characters seems to be like super quick-witted and fast talking. The dialogue is so sharp. It's all kind of surreal and like a throwback to another era. It feels it's more Tarantino, honestly, than even Pulp Fiction, because Tarantino, I usually find Pulp Fiction's like a great movie. It's like very self-contained, and it's really well done.
And it doesn't have some of those things in it that feel like in Pulp Fiction. There's not just a weird scene where all the parties come together and there's a shootout. Now there is kind of with them in the store at the end, but it's not. You look at Inglourious Basterds. You look at Django Unchained. You look at Seven. What's the movie called? Seven.
Hateful Eight.
Or Hateful Eight. There's all that shootout with the parties. They all have that. And you know.
Yeah. He just. I think most of his movies aren't as good as Pulp Fiction. I think that's like his best movie. Just the fact that this movie is driven by the character it's driven by, and the way that he talks, the fact that he works in a comic book store. It's even set in Tarantino universe, even though Tarantino didn't direct it. Harvey Keitel in Reservoir Dogs makes a reference to a character named Alabama.
Yeah.
That's the character.
That's her. Yeah.
There are a couple different connections of the various characters. Lee Donowitz is another character that's referenced in another movie. So it's just interesting stuff. I don't think that there's really a movie, even ones he directed, that are more representative of him. It just feels like he is Clarence. He wanted to be Clarence. That's the character he is. He's even gone on record as saying it's the most autobiographical film he ever made.
Yeah, absolutely. And which is why it's so interesting to me that he decided to let Tony Scott direct it, or not really let him, but option the script to be sold to have someone else direct it. It's very surprising, but he even said that Scott just did it basically perfectly, and the only thing that Scott did change was the ending.
Yeah.
And Tarantino actually liked it more because people loved Clarence and Alabama so much. So my thesis is going to be a little more broad.
Okay.
And it is, you don't agree with me. I'm okay with that. Other people don't agree with me. I'm also okay with that. I think that Gary Oldman is the greatest character actor of all time, period. And I think that the only thing that is stopping him from everyone thinking that is he's going to win for Darkest Hour, which is not one of those... It's not the same thing as Denzel winning and Leo winning, one for Revenant and one for Training Day. It's not just like an honorary Oscar. I've heard that Darkest Hour is one of the greatest performances ever. He disappears completely. He looks like a different human being.
He's great.
He changes his speech pattern, his posture, the way he walks, the way he does everything. Go back and look at this guy's career. He's played Dracula. He's played an evil Russian many times. He's played a psychopath in Leon. He's played Drexel, which is like, the dude is, I don't want to say he's black, but he's like, he basically comes off like a black guy.
I mean, he's written in the script as you are a white pimp that thinks he is a black guy.
Exactly.
That's what it says in the script, like verbatim.
And he's like a soft-spoken British dude. Go watch Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Go watch him in any speech. And then you go and you look at him as fucking one of the greatest, and I know this is your favorite, is Jim Gordon.
Yeah, he's so good.
Because that's finally, everyone's like, you can see him be crazy. He's so good at being crazy. Well, what about him being just an everyday man that's out of his element always? And that's Jim Gordon.
Totally agree. It's unbelievable. He's one of my favorite actors, one of the greatest actors of all time. The only reason I disagree with you is not because I doubt his...
Because you want to fight me?
His prowess as an actor. It's that I think it's hard to call him a character actor, which is a weird distinction.
And so on the AMA question, which we're not really going to answer any of them because we're in the past and that was in our future... I did see them, though, and I saw that. It's like, he's played a lead so many times.
I mean, all those roles you mentioned were like, he played Dracula, he played Sid Vicious, he played...
He played Stancia, he played Zorg, played Drexel Spivvy. Like, these characters... So you go and you look at him, movies where...
Like Beethoven. I mean, he's a true leading man.
He is. But are any of those leading men Gary Oldman playing a heightened version of himself?
No.
Just like Chris Pine, Kevin Costner, Brad Pitt, Leo even.
Denzel for the most part.
Like, the only other people that I think are in this contest
are people like Daniel Day-Lewis and Philip Seymour Hoffman. But Daniel Day-Lewis would never take a secondary role in a movie. He is a true and only leading man. Whereas Drexel Spivey...
Yeah, he's in the movie for five minutes.
In like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, like he is one of the lead characters, but it's a shared cast. And
yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah. He's an ensemble guy. I mean, I don't disagree with you. I don't Jim disagree Gordon. With you that much. He's yeah. I think that's a bold distinction, and I will.
Or you can say that he's the greatest character lead actor ever.
Yeah.
Or something like that. His leads are crazy characters.
Yeah.
You know?
He's really a lot more like we thought Johnny Depp was. He's like, he's a lot more like we thought Johnny Depp was 10 years ago, and then the wheels started to come off. But yeah, he's managed to make an entire career out of the kind of roles you're talking about, and he's never really faltered. It's pretty freaking remarkable. So with that in mind, I say let's discuss top five Gary Oldman roles. I don't want to rank them because I think it's difficult and I don't really want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote down my five favorites.
Okay.
My five favorite Gary Oldman roles. And I do want to throw out an honorable mention to a film called State of Grace from 1990. That's an amazing movie. If you guys haven't seen it, it was in his era you were talking about when he was playing crazy and everybody's like, yeah, this guy's so good at playing crazy. He's like this insane old buddy of Sean Penn's. I think he goes out in a blaze of glory in the movie. It's been a while since I've seen it. He's freaking awesome, though.
And I want to make a shout out to Tiptoes. Go watch the trailer.
Tiptoes?
Yeah, go watch the trailer.
What is it?
It's like a... Yeah, it's like a... It looks like a spoof. It looks like a Saturday Night Live movie made about a guy.
Huh.
And he played... It's just... It's the one movie.
It's not out yet?
No, it came out in like the 80s.
Oh.
It's a joke.
Tiptoes.
Tiptoes. Like, hilarious.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've seen it, Marissa?
I have.
It's really bad. It's like, it's so bad that it's good, right?
Yes, it's so bad.
Yeah, exactly.
I was just going to say, it's a great movie because it's so bad.
It's so bad. I actually did rank mine.
Okay, you know what? Then if you want to go first,
yeah,
I'm going to go
my fifth, my number five, and I know I'm missing Beethoven and Dracula. There's so many I'm missing, I'm going to go Zorg.
Okay.
I love Zorg. I think what I love so much about this role is it's so ridiculous. It's so over the top, and he owns it like he does all of his roles.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he makes it legit.
I'm going to go with my number five, and it's going to be Stansfield from Leon. I think he's so incredible in that role. It's a movie that I'm going to need to go back and watch again soon because I haven't seen it since high school, and not a lot of it has stuck with me.
Uh-huh.
I can think of scenes. I can remember him being crazy. He's the most memorable part of the movie to me. I love him in the movie. Maybe he rises higher on my list when I watch it again,
yeah.
But that's my number five. I do love him in that movie. We'll probably do that movie on here someday, I'll bet.
I'm sure we will. Yeah. It's not really an action movie, but there's enough. Number four is Drexel Spivey.
Okay.
He's just, for all the reasons I just said in my thesis, he's just perfect.
My number four is going to be Darkest Hour, Winston Churchill.
I still haven't seen it, which I'm sure he'd be in my top five.
It's
after
amazing. He's the best part of the movie. He's the only thing in the movie that you're really watching. I mean, Ben Mendelsohn's really good, and the whole movie's really good, but he's just amazing.
I heard it's just magnetizing.
Yeah.
Mesmerizing.
It's incredible.
Magnetic.
Magnetizing. Turns you into a magnet.
Turning three words into one. My number three is Jim Gordon.
Okay.
It's just, I love watching him just be a normal guy who kind of loses it sometimes.
Yeah. He's great. My number three is Drexel. Okay. He's just great, man. There's so much about that role. He had his wig guy that had worked on Dracula make the Drexel wig for him. He took one of the eyes that he wore as Dracula and used it as the character. He's gone on record as saying his two favorite characters he's ever played are Drexel and Lee Harvey Oswald and JFK.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And Drexel, like, it's people talk about Drexel. He's like a character that gets referenced. It's not like we just love him. He's like one of the things in this movie that gets talked about the most.
Yeah,
it's basically the Sicilian scene and this and Drexel.
And you would think that Drexel, not watching the movie, he'd be in it more.
Yeah.
In the trailers and based off of the advertising, but no. My number two... Ivan Khrushchev.
Yeah.
I just, the Air Force One,
it's
the
also
greatest.
Also my number two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you refuel plane or plane crash? one of my favorites. And my number one is Stansfield.
Okay.
It just, that crack in the pill in the neck, and he's a psycho.
He's a total psycho.
He's a fucking terrifying psychopath, and he's totally believable.
Scared the shit out of you as a kid, I'll bet.
Oh, yeah.
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 I love that you watched that movie as a little kid. My number one's Jim Gordon.
I knew it.
I just... I was looking at all the roles, and it's like the most subtle of all the roles, but it's the one to me that feels almost the most technically. It's like Drexel has probably, I shouldn't say the most anything, because each one of these I can think of a real reason to describe why it's so great.
But yeah.
Jim Gordon through three movies is just like, he's so calm and confident and endearing, and like he's just this great cop, and you just believe him so much as this character.
He never takes away from the films. He only adds to them. He just, watching Gary Oldman play Jim Gordon, for some reason, even though it's one of the biggest roles and biggest movies of all time, it's like humbling almost.
Yeah.
Because he just does it. He never does anything more.
His only really big emotional scene is at the end of
Dark Knight with his kids.
With his kids.
And of course he crushes it.
Yeah, stop pointing that gun at my family.
Gun at my family!
Yeah.
Yeah, he's so good. And his accent just disappearing, picking him up. So those are our top five Oldman. Let us know what your top five Oldmans are in the chat below or on the Action Movie Anatomy fan page. We have a couple fan pages, by the way. We forgot to mention those. We got the Action Movie Anatomy fan page. We're up to 1,200 members in there.
Yeah.
We're also going to be doing the Action Movie Fan Awards very soon. I think we've finally compiled the list. We've gotten all the numbers. We'll probably be covering them the next couple weeks.
Shout them out the next few weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's also the Action Army, which is a fan group created for our personas on the Movie Trivia Schmodown. Mm-hmm. And then last, we have a Patreon, actually.
Yeah. We got another general in it, Jason Haywood. Thank you so much.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the Patreon, for those wondering, is we are doing extra videos every single week. So mm-hmm. with the time you watch this, there'll be a set of videos of us reacting to the newest, most exciting trailers that have just come out.
Yeah.
Mission Impossible 6, isn't there?
Mission Impossible 6.
And also, you know, we have some top five lists you guys sent in that we're reviewing there as well. So it's a Patreon really to support us doing additional movie content for you guys. Patreon.com/teamaction. Even $5 a month, you can send in your top five lists and we'll review them on the show and talk about them. So thanks everybody for that. And Jason Haywood for becoming a general in the Action Army. We salute you, sir.
Absolutely.
So let's get into the next part of the show. It's fist pump moment. This is that moment in the movie. Something happens. You look around. You're like, God, this is so good. Are you seeing this right now? This is amazing. I get to watch the rest of this movie. You call your buddy, try to get him on the phone. It's exciting. Mine is a quiet moment.
Yours is a quiet moment. So I'm going to go with mine first because I really do like yours. So I had a couple, like I always do. I think I've said that 100 times on this show, but went with the one.
Yep.
And it was my favorite line, but I realized it's just not. It's just the moment I rewound it because it was so awesome. And it's when Slater comes back from killing Drexel and his guard. He's messed up.
Yeah, he's beaten up
badly. And he's got the food, you know, and she's like, what happened? He's, you know, and he tells her, and she's like, that's so you think she's gonna freak. She goes, romantic, and just like hug. Oh my god, she is so endearing and amazing, and in that moment you're just like, these two people are perfect for each other.
Yep.
You and Miss Roxy Stryer watched the movie 2 nights ago.
Yeah, we were watching.
You had a moment, and I want you to tell me that we talked about it on the phone. Tell me about
that
moment.
Because when it first started, the movie started, and we were kind of like, she was like, do you think she's pretty? I was like, I mean, she's pretty. She's like, you know, she's not my style, really. I don't think she's like, you know, drop dead or anything like that. And she was like, yeah, she's really pretty. And 10 minutes later, that scene had happened. And Roxy just looked over at me and she's like, she's totally won me over. She was like, she's so endearing. She's totally won me over. And I was like, yeah, you're right. She's like, she's just great. She really brings it in this role and is just, she's just fantastic. I'm just a big fan.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I love about Patricia Arquette. And Patricia Arquette is a very beautiful woman.
Gorgeous.
But she's not one of those people, like, for instance, Gal. Right now, where you look at her and you're just kind of like, you just can't not. But what's so amazing, and like Drew Barrymore has these qualities too, is there was something just so endearing about them on screen where they were just, they're either so sweet or they're just so good at being this role. And like Patricia Arquette as Alabama might be her greatest role ever.
Maybe, even though she won the Oscar for Boyhood.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, she's excellent. She's wonderful. I love her in this movie.
Yeah, so that's my fist pump. It's when she goes, it's so romantic, you know, the line, and the movie hasn't even started yet.
Yeah,
you know, you don't really know what's going to happen. Yeah.
So my favorite moment in this movie, my fist pump moment, is when it's when Christopher Walken comes into Dennis Hopper's trailer and he's interrogating him and he's talking to him. It's right before the whole Sicilian monologue gets delivered, and he gives him the whole line about, you know, there are 20 tells that a man has to know if he's lying. And he's like, you know, whatever. Women have 27, men have 20 or something like that, or 18.
Better than you know your own face.
Yeah. And you kind of see Hopper pause for a second, and he's already had his hand slashed open, and he's
sitting punched
there.
In the face.
He's, you know, there's all these guys around with guns, and I think there's this moment, and Hopper pauses for a second after he says that, and he asks him for a cigarette. And he asks him real calmly. And the way he asks, you can tell what's happening is he's like, you know what? I'm never going to say a word about my son, and I'm going to die here.
Yep.
And I want to calmly enjoy this cigarette, because it's probably the last one I'm ever going to get.
This is probably the last good, nice moment I'm going to get.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so he asks him for it, and he gets that cigarette, and then he delivers the monologue. And it's like, it's just such a great moment. It's such a great moment of writing. It's so well directed. It's like, it's just beautiful, because you just don't, he's not saying at all what he's thinking, but he's saying everything with what he's doing.
Exactly, exactly. Which is why Walken even says that, exactly what you just said. He says, I don't remember exactly what the line is, but he talks about like things you say and things you're doing in that monologue, because it's basically just being like, I know what you're doing, man.
Yeah.
You know, and that scene is the most Quentin Tarantino scene I think ever.
It's, I mean, like it's the most quoted and memorable and discussed scene in this movie.
In this movie, but like, you think about all the things that are said in it, the comedy in it, the racism behind it, Walken being in it, you know, because it's like, you know, go to Pulp Fiction, Walken's in one scene as well.
Yeah.
You know, and it's so, So did you even say your moment yet?
No, I did. Yeah, yeah.
You did. When it's just when he asked for the cigarette.
I just had a moment where I paused, and I just thought it was such a great moment. This movie, honestly, in a way that doesn't happen that often when I'm watching movies, I just found my jaw kind of dropped the whole time. Like, I felt like I was watching something really magical. And it's, I loved this movie, and I liked it a lot when I first watched it, and I liked it even more this time through. And it just felt special. That moment, I remember I looked over at Roxy and I said, you know, I'll bet you that's my fist bump moment.
Yeah.
I said, honestly, I'll bet you that moment of him asking for the cigarette is going to be the one I talk about. And it was. It totally was. Nothing else in the movie, like, kind of affected me quite as much.
Yeah, that's such a great scene. Hopper is fantastic in that.
They have a great relationship in this movie, Hopper and his son. I like when he shows up and he's kind of like, yeah, I haven't seen you in 3 years. You show up, you're married. Slow down.
Yeah.
You know?
I got my life here.
Whatever he says. That's great, because I like that line, because it's like a reminder that he's just this dad who's like, living in a trailer park. He's just a man. He's living his own life. His kid's not really his concern anymore. Mm-hmm. And his life's getting kind of interrupted. I always like father characters like that, because it feels much more realistic. It's like,
yeah, instead of just dropping everything to just be daddy again.
But then he does a little bit. He protects his son.
I mean,
he gives his life to protect his son.
Because that's what you have to do, I think, as a father. And I think that's a really, really well written. It's perfect. It's perfectly written. So, guys, moving on to star profiles, we've got Christian Slater and Patricia Arquette, who were both doing pretty well. This was kind of Christian Slater's peak, though, honestly, in my opinion.
Yeah, he's had a long career now. His way up was like, should have sort of, he was a big star, because with Broken Arrow is like 96.
Yeah,
right?
So it's like really the early to mid 90s is when he's peaking and just kind of crushing. He's in everything. So Cuffs is in 92, which I love that movie.
I've told you
about that movie many times.
Cuffs.
It's an awesome, like, it feels like it's in the 80s because it's 92. He's a cop. It's good, though. It's actually like a really funny, like, fun action comedy. Next, you got Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest.
You've also seen that film?
Yeah, oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
You haven't seen?
Of course I've seen Fern Gully.
Yeah.
You know what the best piece of trivia about Fern Gully is?
Tim Curry plays the voice of the villain?
No, it's the fact that Fern Gully came out the same year as Aladdin, and Robin Williams did a voice in both movies. He did two animated voices the same year, one of which is regarded as, like, one of the great all-time voices. The fact, like, I can't, when I read that and realized it, he does the little bat, right?
Is that
I was like, I couldn't believe that he had done two voices in 1 year. His role in Fern Gully is just so overshadowed by the genie.
I just love him so much.
Yeah.
I miss him. And then Patricia Arquette, I really don't know her career that well. She's had a very interesting one. She's never really kind of been just in the limelight. She's always kind of, like, dipped in and out.
Yeah, she has movies here and there she's done. She's not somebody I'm super familiar with. I would say this is probably her most famous movie.
Yeah, I mean, because even though Boyhood is
recent.
Yeah, it's too recent, and it's too indie, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Boyhood did well, and people saw it, and she was really great in Boyhood. She's just not someone who's had... It's not like when you were looking at Oldman's career, and you're like, what are his 10 best? And you're like, oh, these 10 are all amazing. Wow, I can do 5 only?
Right.
I mean, before we move on, actually, let's just talk... Let's move on.
Okay.
Let's get into production development, because there's a bit here about Oldman and his roles. I included some of the stuff that I mentioned. One of the things that I think is really interesting is that he met with Tony Scott, Oldman, and Scott offered him the role, and Oldman was like, I didn't read the script. And he was like, this is what he says. He's like, you're playing a white guy who thinks he's black, and you're a killer pimp. Oldman laughed immediately and accepted the role.
Yeah.
I love the fact that Oldman was just like, sure. And what's really interesting about him is that Oldman is a lot like Tom Hardy is right now.
Oldman's a lot like Drexel Spivey.
Tom Hardy right now is very much what Gary Oldman was in 1993.
Okay.
The only major difference is that Hardy hadn't had... Oldman had had, like, several roles that were, like, iconic, big, everybody saw the movie type of roles. Like, right. Dracula is the biggest difference, I'd say. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like if Tom Hardy, once he plays... If he had played like a political leader in like an Oscar-nominated movie at this point that was like well-loved.
Or like even if the characters from Lawless were like famous.
Something.
Something
where people had seen the movie, they'd be very similar because they were both kind of these very good at being crazy, kind of brooding guys, right like in their 30s, kind of in their prime. Everybody kind of just loved him. But if you think about like Oldman, that same year, he plays Beethoven. The previous year, he's Dracula. Mm-hmm. Like I said, the Professional is the next year. He was already in Sid and Nancy. That's in the late 80s. Romeo is Bleeding, I think, is like right around the same time.
People like that movie.
Romeo's Bleeding is great. He was in a ton of stuff. Everybody knew he was a great actor, and he just wasn't quite like a movie star yet. But he was the kind of guy that would show up in a role like this, and that a director like Tony Scott would kill to have him in his movie.
Right.
He'd be like, I want you. You're the guy. It's like if you were a director and you had the opportunity to offer Tom Hardy like a 10-minute role in your movie as like, a crazy, weird character actor, you'd be like, anything you want. You haven't even seen the script yet, but just...
Doesn't matter.
However you want to play it, you do it. If you'll be in my movie as this character, it would make my life.
Which, I mean, the teeth, the eyes, the hair, all the skin, the tattoos, the accent, the delivery, like everything about it is... I don't think that it could have been any better in either of their minds.
No, it's fantastic.
All three of them, yeah.
So moving on to the people that made the film. So Tarantino. So this is uncomfortable. We announced this movie about a week and a half ago, and it was 2 days before the Tarantino Uma Thurman story had broken. Which then was followed by the Tarantino Roman Polanski story, which was even worse.
And
we didn't realize that this movie was produced by Harvey Weinstein.
So happy Valentine's Day. The show's been canceled.
We've been fired.
Yeah.
We don't want to really belabor these two points. Enough has been said about Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, we don't really want to speak their praises either, so we're just going to do what we do, and we're going to talk about the facts.
Yes, absolutely. Weinstein we can just ignore, because Miramax made a lot of very, very successful movies, and that's all we really need to know. He's disgusting.
Quentin Tarantino wrote this movie, and he was originally going to direct it, and he decided to option that to sell the script. He sold the script for the bare minimum of the WGA rules, the Writers Guild Association, for $50,000, and it was soon thereafter announced that Tony Scott would be directing it.
Yeah, so that's pretty interesting. We can talk a little about Tony Scott. If you guys watch the show or listen to the show, you know how much we love Tony Scott.
Tony Scott is in your top 10, or maybe even top 10. Yeah, I'll say 10.
I think top 10 directors of all time. I love Tony Scott. He directed 5 movies with Denzel Washington, all of which I love.
Yeah.
As well as Top Gun, this movie. He's actually a great director. He's like a very unsung director for how great he was. And he was able to execute dramatic, beautiful moments inside action movies in a way that very few directors have ever been able to do. He had this big budget sensibility, but just he was never going to stop from putting these really emotional, kind of heavy-handed moments into his movies. He would always swing for the fences with those moments, and a lot of the time they work.
Yeah, and the thing, I'd say most of the time they work, and like those moments are our favorite thing about taking Pelham 1-2-3 and Man on Fire and Unstoppable and Deja Vu, and what it is he really figured out how to do that. I wonder what would have happened if he were to just direct like a hardcore drama. Just straight up.
He was never really interested, right?
I don't think he could do. He always wanted to do action.
He just wanted to have these big set pieces, and that's the kind of jobs he kept getting.
Was put in the right place to have a film filled with those emotional moments.
It might just be too heavy-handed.
Might be too much. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But so he directed this film. It was written by Tarantino. So at the time, and this is, I think, one of the things that's the most interesting about this movie, we mentioned a little bit sort of the era of filmmaking that this was in. So Reservoir Dogs comes out in 92. It's the previous year. And it was a total festival hit at Sundance. Everybody loved it. Great writing. All the stuff that the Tarantinoisms that we came to know and love were all in that movie. This script was sold, was made with a much bigger budget by a director that had had recent successes. I mean, in the previous few years, he had directed Top Gun and The Last Boy Scout, Beverly Hills Cop 2. He was making movies that were making money. So the studio was going to give him a budget. So he was able to get all these big actors who were on their way up. A lot of these guys were huge already, and a lot of them were sort of character-y guys that had big careers. But what ended up happening from this movie forward is, like, this feels as much like a Tarantino or more like a Tarantino-directed movie than any movie, because Pulp Fiction's the next year. Mm-hmm. Roger Avery, who co-wrote this film, ended up directing a film called Killing Zoe a few years later.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
you have all these rip-off movies like Eight Heads in a Duffel Bag, Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead, Get Shorty. And then he ends up doing Jackie Brown a few years later. The 90s was just filled with these, like, cooler-than-cool hitman crime movies. Everybody wanted to write a hitman crime movie. So much so that Boondock Saints ended up actually getting made, and
people loved it for some reason for so long.
And it's like kind of just the ultimate, like, fanboy watches Pulp Fiction is like, I want to make my own Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, that movie was like so highly regarded in high school, and it's just a joke now.
It's a bad movie.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of fascinating, is that, like, this movie kicks off that genre in a lot of ways, but it's not a Quentin Tarantino directed film. I think that's maybe the most interesting part.
Yeah, and one thing that I thought was super interesting, because I even said to you during it, and it's very reflective of your thesis, is that Quentin Tarantino said he never visited the set of the movie.
Even once, I know.
And that's shocking to me, because what I said to you before reading that was, I bet you Tarantino directed it with him on set.
It seemed like it.
It seemed like it, but he sure as hell didn't.
Yeah, it's also sort of weird that, like, we talk a lot about how Michael Bay and Tony Scott, there's like a comparison, but that Tony Scott just seems to understand drama so much more.
Yeah.
It's funny that the movies...
And respect people.
It's funny that all of the movies from that time were bringing in Quentin Tarantino to punch up their script. So, like, Tarantino writes some of The Rock, and he writes some of Crimson Tide.
Yeah, exactly.
And he gets brought in to, like, punch up the script.
Which is so crazy that he was selling this script for $50,000 when he was, like, clearly already been, like... This guy knows how to write.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
One thing that is interesting, we will talk about Harvey, is that Harvey Weinstein thought that Christian Slater was too good looking to play Clarence, and he thought that Steve Buscemi should be playing him instead, so much so that he decided to go to Warner Brothers producers and tell them that Steve Buscemi is going to be playing the role. They responded quickly and told him to get the hell out and fired him.
Yep.
And then it led to the beginning of the end of both of them, and he was like, all right, so cool. Tarantino, you and I are going to become partners after this movie. And the rest is history.
And we're never going to work with Warren Brothers again.
Yep.
So just a classic example of that dude. so this is early Tarantino. I think that genre and everything that happened in the 90s is pretty fascinating stuff. It's just like it was a moment in time. And every movie nerd knew about this movie and movies like this movie in a way that, like I said, I have friends that are in that age and in their mid-40s now. A lot of those friends of ours we see, you know, competing on Schmodown and stuff, and it's like they're from an era where, like, this movie was the coolest thing when they were in their 20s. It's just like a funny, so how times change. All right, anyway, so moving on to critical and box office.
Yeah, this movie was not successful at all monetarily. So it was produced by Warner Brothers. It cost $12.5 million to make. It was released September 10th of 93, and all it grossed was $12.2 million. So it actually lost money, and it didn't open worldwide. It was only domestic, and like I said, it was $12.2 million. Its opening weekend, it opened at number three at $4 million, which was $300,000 behind Undercover Blues at number two, and The Fugitive just dominating, doubling its profits at $8 million. Which is interesting because you go back and you look, and it's like The Fugitive and True Romance are pretty much held in the same category of classic crime films.
Totally.
And you can see here when we go into critical reception, IMDb gives it a 7.9, but Rotten Tomatoes, all critics give it a 92. The top critics give it an 82, and the audience gives it a 93, which is massive.
Yeah, I think I read, like, Empire magazine a few years ago marked this as, like, the 140th best film ever made or something.
Yeah, yeah, and I actually want to segue that into a segment. My original thesis was going to be that the greatest part of this film are all the supporting characters.
Yeah, because so many of these guys were on their way up.
Mm-hmm, but I didn't do that. But I do think that we should rank some of the supporting characters. There are so many A-listers in here.
Yeah, there's like 10 guys in this movie beyond just the initial cast that are all fantastic. So I think we can kick a couple guys off the list just because they're they're in tiny scenes, or they weren't quite as big. So Chris Penn, Michael Rapaport, Sam Jackson, they had careers, but they're not like, I mean, friggin' Brad Pitt's in this movie is a stone on a couch.
Yeah, you know, and he's Brad Pitt. So good at it.
So let's go in reverse order with our rankings. Who do you got at number seven?
So on number seven, I have Tom Sizemore.
Okay, you put Sizemore.
I think he's great. He just does it. He just does what he's supposed to. He's funny enough, and he dies.
He does. I'm going to go Brad Pitt, number seven.
Okay.
He's a great stoner. Did you read the thing that the character of James Franco's character in Pineapple Express
is just him?
Is based on this character?
No, but it makes perfect sense. Yeah, they look the same, and
he gets up and like runs from the bad guys. Like, yeah. That's like the whole idea.
That's fucking great. Yeah. Number six, I have Kilmer as Elvis.
Okay, I have him a little higher. I go Sizemore at six.
Okay, I was bummed that Kilmer wasn't in the movie more. I wanted him to be a main character. Number five, I have Brad Pitt because he crushes that role.
Yeah, he's great.
He's so good at it.
Yeah, I go Kilmer five. One of the many actors to play Elvis.
Yeah.
Though he's not actually credited as Elvis. He's credited as like a mentor or something.
Yeah, a mentor.
They didn't want to deal with the estate. The fourth one I'm going to go with is going to be Dennis Hopper.
And I have Christopher Walken.
Okay, Walken's fantastic. Yep. Walken's fantastic. I have Walken three.
And my number three is Hopper, so we flopped those two.
I think, like, those two kind of live in the same space for me because of the one scene.
Yeah, and they're kind of just being themselves.
Yeah.
But they're just powerhouse actors.
Great actors, yeah, at that point.
I think it's actually your fist pump is what changed my mind.
Yeah, yeah. Hopper never won an Oscar. Walken did. Walken had two Oscar noms. This is actually an interesting piece of trivia. So
Hopper has a few Oscar noms, yeah, too, doesn't he?
I think he does. Obviously, Walken, most people remember that he won the Oscar for Deer Hunter, because it's like his most famous scene. His other Oscar noms in one of my favorite movies.
Nom or win?
Nom. He only has one other nomination.
Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah, yeah, he's the dad.
Of course.
And he has a great scene in that movie. He has several.
Yeah, his rapport with Leo and that is brilliant.
And they're at the bar, and he's like, "Where's she going home? Where are you going home tonight?" And he's telling the story about his wife. That's a heartbreaking scene.
Yeah, it really is.
The movie is so underrated. That movie is so good.
It really is one of the most underrated films ever.
Yeah.
Especially in Spielberg, Leo, and Hank's catalog.
Yeah, I think about O2, and I'm like, Chicago, Catch Me If You Can. Give me Catch Me If You Can any day of the week.
Yeah, Catch Me If You Can is amazing.
Catch Me If You Can didn't even get nominated for Best Picture.
And Chicago it definitely won. Should have been. It should have been nominated for sure.
I think like the movies in 02 they got nominated. It's like a pretty interesting year. I'm pretty sure it's like Adaptation, The Pianist, Chicago, like The Hours.
The Pianist or Adaptation should have won. Pianist is phenomenal.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
So my number two is Gandolfini.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, and so number one's Oldman.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, of course it is.
Yeah, we don't need to say more about him. No. Gandolfini, though, was totally on his way up in 93. He was a guy that, like, because so he shows up a couple years later in Crimson Tide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a little more svelte than he ends up in the later 90s. And then his whole career just flips on a dime, and he becomes Tony Soprano in 98.
He is so creepy, sleazy, scummy, trash person, garbage people in this movie. And he is so good at it.
I didn't realize that he's in Taking of Pelham, which is Tony Scott.
Yep. He's in Crimson Tide.
Tony Scott. He's in this movie. Yeah. It's just Tony Scott. I'd actually never thought about that.
I'm sure Tony loved Gandolfini.
Yeah.
How could you not?
Yeah.
So those are our rankings. Those are the seven that we ranked. Again, please throw those in the comments or put them up on the Facebook fan page.
Yeah. Next up, we've got favorite line. Yes. Let's share our favorite lines here. If you guys have any you want to share, make sure to post them in the Facebook group, or you can leave them in the chat here. Andrew hopefully is in the chat with you in the future.
Yeah, hopefully. So I have a handful.
All right.
But my so – I have to do the – the fuck is dick? And he goes, you want me to suck his dick? I laughed out loud. He's like, no, who's dick? Oh, he's my buddy from acting class. That is really good. But my favorite for sure is when they are talking, or when Gandolfini's beating the life out of Patricia Arquette,
yeah,
and he sits there and he's talking about the first time he kills someone.
Yeah.
The first time you take out that black dot, the sniper, and then the second,
yeah,
and the third time, and then he goes, now, shit. He goes, I just do it to watch their fucking expressions change. It's such a good line.
Yeah.
And the way he says it, that look on his face, and he starts laughing about it. He's like, you really had it under the fucking bed? I didn't think about looking under the bed. You would. You did, didn't you? You're just like, I hate you, but I love you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's mine. The other one that I had is of minor importance, which is of major fucking importance, that I believe you.
Yeah.
Is when Walken's talking about who believes who.
There's so many good lines in the Walken scene. So many good lines. And it's also just great that Walken's only in it for the one scene. I think probably my favorite lines, either when Hopper says to him, you know, Clarence, I haven't seen you in 3 years. Slow down. Slow down. Yeah. I love that moment. I also really love when Drexel's talking to Clarence and he's like throwing the light back and forth at him. He's throwing the light. He's like, sit down. Have an egg roll. Have an egg roll.
Boy roll.
Yeah.
Who's a white boy night?
What must be white boy night. Yeah. Crazy white boy night. He's just amazing. That guy's just what a great character.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that you said that his two of all the roles he's played, his two favorites are, which I need to go watch him be Lee Harvey Oswald again if you liked it that much.
I don't remember JFK.
Yeah. And then Drexel, like, that's crazy.
I know. I could have interviewed him this year. I can't remember what ended up happening the night of that premiere, Darkest Hour. I couldn't cover it, but
it's a bummer.
Yeah. It bummed me out because he's one of my all timers. But I'm almost happy that I went back and watched this again. So that I think if I do talk to Oldman the next time, it'll be Drexel and James Gordon will be the characters I ask about. Because, like,
yeah.
I'd love to ask him about Drexel. I'm sure he's got asked him about it 100 times, but I would love to talk to him about Drexel.
Yes. I mean, I'm sure he loved, like you said, if it's one of his favorites, I bet he would love to talk about it.
He said in an interview once that he would have loved to have done a Drexel spinoff movie. Its own character.
I'd watch it.
Yeah. I mean, at this point,
be like, a good guy.
65-year-old Gary Oldman reprising a dead character. The Drexel prequel.
He's got old, man.
All right. So moving on, guys, to the last bit of the show. There are three action movie categories. This is an interesting one.
Yeah.
There's three action movie categories. Totally ridiculous, totally legitimate, ridiculously legitimate. Those categories are here to, like, totally ridiculous, like Face Off, Con Air, Demolition Man. Yeah. Really silly, kind of just laugh. They're great, but they're funny and kind of dumb.
Yeah.
The ridiculous or the
Tiptoes.
Totally legit category, that's going to be movies like The Fugitive.
Yeah.
Lone Survivor, maybe something like Terminator 2, we put in that category. Totally held together. And then the ridiculously legitimate, which is the middle category, is like a little bit ridiculous, kind of laughable, held together by one really strong component, whether it's a great performance or, you know, some part of the story, something really engaging.
The Rock, Point Break, Speed, movies Predator. Like that, Predator. For me, I think I got to jump in and say that it's ridiculously legitimate.
Yeah.
Even though it feels totally legit, there's something about Tarantino movies that you don't want them to be totally legitimate.
Right.
Because totally legit, what would happen is that this guy would get his ass killed by Christopher Walken within like a week of them finding him. Floyd would have gotten killed on the couch. Everyone would die.
Yeah, right.
You know, people would be tortured and like things like that. I like that it's a little far-fetched. I like that it's kind of like a love story. It's, you know, I like that it's a little fairy tale-ish.
I think I go totally legit.
Yeah, that's fair.
And I think it's tough. It's close on this one because I
shot in the eye. You know.
Yeah, I like want to call it totally, you know, ridiculously legit because, but I think the scenes that you laugh, you're supposed to laugh. And I also think that this movie is so stylized in a way that like it just feels like a more classic piece of cinema in a way.
Yeah.
Feels like it's doing something interesting and unique and different. And like it's early on in the process. So it was like by the time you watch even just Kill Bill, he's made enough movies and he's done it for long enough that it's sort of like hard to decide how much of this is like tongue in cheek and how much of the stylized stuff. I can have a stronger opinion. This movie is like trying to be stylized, but it's also still a pretty traditional movie. Just like a weird story. I don't know. I think I would put this in the totally legit category. It feels like more of a classic than I remembered it.
Yeah, I'm interested if it would have felt more legitimate had they died at the end like Tarantino originally had it written. But we don't know. We will never know.
We will never know. So that's going to wrap us up. We only have one last thing left to talk about. That's going to be called
The Pitch.
So we're not actually sure. We think
it's going to be Black Panther.
I think we're going to be here talking Black Panther next week. There's some craziness that's going on. I have to be in New York next week, and I'm trying to sort something out, and I just realized literally before we hit record, there's a chance we're going to have to air a pre-tape next week. So Black Panther probably? We'll definitely talk Black Panther. It's just a question of when.
And if it's not Black Panther, it will be
Dark Knight Rises.
Dark Knight Rises.
Yes.
Which is great for everyone.
Sweet, so.
So this is the plan, hopefully, is that we can do Black Panther next week.
Yep.
And then the following week we can do Annihilation.
Yep.
The following week we can do Red Sparrow.
Probably,
if it's good. And then the following week we would ideally do Quigley Down Under.
Because welcome to the Action Army.
Jason Haywood, Mr. General.
You are now a general in the Army. And that's one of the perks is that if you become a general in the Army, at some point you get to suggest a film for the show and we do it on the show.
And the other thing is if you are a general, and you continue to be a general, or if you're any of the other levels and you want to continue doing that, there's other prizes. For instance, one of the general options is that Ben and I will pick out a DVD and yeah. send you a handwritten letter and the reason why we picked it out and like why we enjoy you as a fan, things like that.
Things
we
like that, or like a miniature 10-minute AMA on a non-action movie of your mm-hmm. choice that we'll do on the private feed, only available to Patreon subscribers.
Or maybe help us how to decide to enter the Schmodown ring.
Yeah, something. Once Andrew's allowed to come back.
Once I'm unbanned.
So that's going to be it, guys. Thank you so much for watching. Thanks for listening. If you want to follow me anywhere, you can find me on Twitter at Ben Bateman Media.
You guys can find me at Andrew Guy.
And go check out patreon.com/teamaction as well as the Facebook fan pages. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching the show, guys. Have a good one.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.